Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights and Religious Liberties Practice Groups and was recorded on Tuesday, September 10, 2013, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on anti-discrimination and individual liberties, Elaine Photography versus Wilcox. My name is Christian Corgan, and I am the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome Ilya Shapiro, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies and Editor of the Cato Supreme Court Review at the Cato Institute. A more complete bio of our speaker was provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for his presentation. Ilya, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having me on to talk about what's really a cutting-edge issue, this looming conflict between individual liberty and equality, in a certain sense. In this case, between religious liberty and free exercise and marriage equality. This is the case, as those of you who got the announcement about this event, I'm sure are well aware, involves the Albuquerque photography business, Elaine Photography, which is a Christian-identified business that declined to photograph a same-sex commitment ceremony based on the business owner's personal belief. New Mexico law prohibits any refusal to render business services because of sexual orientation, however, among other protected categories, race, religion, gender, other such things. So the Vanessa Wilcox, one of the parties to the same-sex couple, filed a claim with the New Mexico Human Rights Commission. She argued that Elaine Photography is a public accommodation akin to a hotel or restaurant holding a business holding itself open to the public that's subject to the state's anti-discrimination law. The Human Rights Commission found against the photography company and ordered it to pay attorney fees. The owners of the photography company appealed the ruling, arguing that they're being denied their First Amendment right to the free exercise of religion and a similar provision in the state constitution, as well as their free speech and expression rights also under the First Amendment, because, of course, photography is an expressive activity. And they also argued that New Mexico's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is similar to the federal RFRA, it's called, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, defines free exercise as an act or a refusal to act that's substantially motivated by religious belief and forbids government from abridging that right except to, quote, further a compelling government interest. Now, the state trial and appellate courts affirmed the commission's order against Elaine Photography, and then the case reached the state Supreme Court quite a while ago. Over a year ago now, my own organization, Cato, filed a brief supporting the photographer, and we were joined by Professors Dale Carpenter of the University of Minnesota and Professor Eugene Volokh, who actually wrote the brief from UCLA Law School and famously the Volokh Conspiracy blog. And all of us are supporters of same-sex marriage. We filed briefs in the Windsor and Perry cases this past Supreme Court term, arguing that Prop 8 and the Section 3 of DOMA should be struck down on equal protection grounds, etc. But we're also strong believers in individual liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and everything else that the Constitution protects. I'll get into our brief in a moment, but to give you some more background about what the laws in play are, the New Mexico Human Rights Act prohibits, among other things, discriminatory practices against certain defined classes of people. 10 years ago, in 2003, the Act was amended to add sexual orientation as one of the classes of persons that are protected from discriminatory treatment. And sexual orientation is defined as heterosexuality, homosexuality, or bisexuality, whether actual or perceived. And then public accommodation is defined as any establishment that provides or offers its services, facilities, accommodations, or goods to the public, but does not include a bona fide private club or other place or establishment that is by its nature and use distinctly private. So Vanessa Wilcox, contacted Elaine Photography to inquire about their services and see whether they'd be available to photograph her commitment or wedding ceremony. These terms have been used interchangeably throughout the case, to another woman. The co-owner of Elaine Photography, Elaine Huganin, who is opposed to same-sex marriage and won't photograph any image or event that violates her religious beliefs, responded that the photography company only photographs traditional weddings. And when Willock asked a clarifying question about whether that means they don't offer services to same-sex couples, Elaine Huganin responded yes. And then to verify the policy, Willock's partner, Misty Collinsworth, contacted Elaine Photography later and inquired about their services without mentioning the sexes or sexual orientation of the participants, and received in response pricing information and an invitation to meet and discuss their services. So having established the policy, that's when Willock filed her discrimination complaint. And the New Mexico Supreme Court, finally, it took about a year or so, ruled against Elaine Photography, affirming the lower courts and the Human Rights Commission. First of all, it said that the refusal to serve Willock and her partner on the basis of sexual orientation was indeed a violation of the Human Rights Act. So even though Elaine Photography did or is open to providing photography services to people who are gay, as long as it's not affirming a same-sex commitment marriage ceremony. So the objection was to the idea of same-sex marriage, not to someone being a homosexual orientation. And the Supreme Court said that that's six of one, half dozen of the other, that effectively status and conduct are conflated. And I think that's probably a correct reading both of the statute and just general interpretation of what's going on here. This is clearly a decision that was being made based on the sexual orientation of the couple involved. Next, it turned, and here I think things get a little more controversial, the Supreme Court, the New Mexico Supreme Court, turned to Elaine Photography's First Amendment rights. So first, on the freedom of speech, where Elaine Photography argued that her business is an example of expressive speech, and there's a whole slew of Supreme Court cases saying that the government cannot force you to speak. Woolley versus Maynard in 1977, the famous live free or die statement on the New Hampshire license plate. Someone could not be prosecuted for covering that up. They can't be compelled to speak in that way by the state. I actually had an interesting experience with that when I was first registering my car about 9 years ago in D.C. They, of course, have that statement on the standard statement on D.C. license plate is no taxation without representation, and I didn't really feel like engaging in the debate over voting rights every time I drove, so I asked for an alternative, and there is one available in D.C. You can just get a plate with the D.C. government's website on it. Anyhow, the court here found that the Human Rights Act did not compel Elaine Photography to speak any sort of government message. After all, the government is not saying same-sex marriage is good. It's not having someone who's in business adopt any sort of message per se, the court said. They are simply, in their activity, in their business conduct, enforcing an anti-discrimination law. Now, Cato takes issue with this sort of analysis because photography is, you know, we can get into other debates about public accommodations like hotels later, but photography, like certain other kinds of activity or businesses, is an artistic endeavor that requires the input, the knowledge, the aptitude of the of the artist, of the photographer, to take the pictures, to edit them, to touch them up, to crop them, to make them look good. And effectively, if a photographer is taking pictures of something, you know, unless directed otherwise, they're going to try to make good pictures and reflect, have that event or product or what have you portrayed in a positive light. So I think there can be a distinction drawn, as we indicated in our brief and as Elaine Photography argued, between, on the one hand, a wedding photographer or an artist or even, say, a cake maker who has the flourishes on the cake and designs it in a very artistic, expressive manner versus someone who rents out a banquet hall or a caterer that simply provides food. Again, we can debate whether they should be subject to public accommodation laws in general, whether there should be such a thing as anti-discrimination laws in those. But here, when it's an artistic, expressive type of business, I think there's an even clear-cut protection for that First Amendment-protected activity. The court, nevertheless, ruled that the Human Rights Act doesn't compel Elaine Photography to host or accommodate the message of another speaker. They don't have to trumpet. They can even put on their website, "We don't approve of gay marriage," as long as they are available to provide photography services for gay marriages. The court was clear that this is not a censorship provision. This is not a you have to adopt certain types of policies. Messages, rather. There's a case last term at the U.S. Supreme Court, the AID versus Alliance for Open Society Institute case, where to get federal funding, the government was requiring contractors to adopt a certain message regarding prostitution and sex trafficking and things like this in the context of a program about HIV/AIDS, and the Supreme Court said overwhelmingly that that was a bridge too far, that was an unconstitutional condition. But here, there was no message that had to be put up on the website or anything like that. You know, Elaine Photography was welcome to advertise their opposition to gay marriage as long as they still were open to accepting bids or requests to photograph gay marriage or gay commitment ceremonies. And now, query separately, why would a same-sex couple who knows that this business is opposed to those types of ceremonies still insist on trying to make a case out of it? I mean, I think there's a little bit of a mixed or impure motive here, because obviously Elaine Photography is not the only photographer business on the ground. I would even venture to say, I'm not sure if it's in the record, but probably most photographers in New Mexico are open to photographing gay marriages. So this is not, I think, a case like, say, diners or hotels in the Jim Crow South, which were ordered to desegregate by federal courts, because otherwise, essentially, the argument went, the ruling went, black travelers would have nowhere to stay or eat if they were traveling there and impeded on their rights in that way. So the court concluded that observers are unlikely to believe that Elaine Photography's photographs reflect the views either of its owners or its employees. And so Elaine Photography's protestations to the contrary, there is no exemption from anti-discrimination laws for creative or expressive professions. And the court did talk about wedding cakes, flower shops, you know, florists putting together a design could be expressive as well. And this, you know, makes one think of even more recently than this case that was decided 2 weeks ago. There was this Oregon bakery that you might have heard of that was not just required to provide baked goods to same-sex ceremonies, but there were statements from the human rights officials, so-called in the state, that they wanted to rehabilitate the bake shop. I mean, this is really, I wouldn't say Orwellian. I mean, Orwellian is a sense, but it's something from the Soviet commissars of political correctness that I know a lot of us are sensitive to. So moving from the First Amendment, or from the free speech arguments, and that's especially what Cato was filing about, but moving to the free exercise of religion aspect of the First Amendment, Elaine Photography argued that by requiring the business, the photographers, to photograph these ceremonies, which they felt were against their religious belief, that infringed on their rights. But the New Mexico Supreme Court said, under the famous case of Employment Division versus Smith in 1990, the right of free exercise does not relieve an individual of the obligation to comply with a valid and neutral law of general applicability on the ground that the law prescribes or prescribes conduct that his religion prescribes or proscribes. So in other words, if you pass a neutral law, you know, you cannot bring guns into federal courts. If it's against your religion not to have your gun strapped to you, tough, effectively, as long as that rule isn't arbitrary. And even under the heightened standard of the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the RFRA, that Congress passed after Employment Division versus Smith, I think even the gun in a federal courthouse exception would probably fit that too. The government would point to the compelling interest to maintain the security of courthouses, which are, after all, doling out justice, and there are criminals involved, et cetera, sensitive government facilities. I think that would be an easy case to make. Obviously, an extreme example of a free exercise claim, but that's the way that the law is structured. So the court finds that the Human Rights Act is a neutral law of general applicability. No public accommodation can discriminate on the basis of these protected categories, including sexual orientation. It's not just targeting photographers or religious organizations or anything like that. And moreover, the enforcement of the New Mexico Human Rights Act doesn't violate the New Mexico Religious Freedom Restoration Act, because that state RFRA isn't applicable in a suit between private parties. Here, I think, is another, I think, point of real controversy, because, again, remember that even a generally applicable law might fail as applied if the government hasn't narrowly tailored it to avoid infringing individual constitutionally protected individual rights, or if it's not, if the government doesn't have a compelling interest to pursue it. So I think just by saying that this is a suit between individuals at the end of the day, the same-sex couple and the photography company, clearly it's the New Mexico government, the Human Rights Commission, and later the courts that are enforcing this law against the exercise of the religious liberties that are being asserted here. Now, the court parses the language of the New Mexico RFRA by saying that this has to be a government agency, and courts are not government agencies, and moreover, private litigants are not government agencies. I'm not sure how it, you know, if and then it says the commission also isn't, because the commission didn't create the RFRA, the state legislature did. So anyway, I think it kind of slices and dices a little too much here to say that the state RFRA doesn't apply. So I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, unless I'm missing, you know, I'm obviously not an expert on New Mexico law and how its RFRA has become interpreted, but it seems to me that Elaine Photography should win on that basic state statutory claim before even getting to the free exercise or free speech claims under the U.S. Constitution. So, but anyhow, the court obviously unanimously, I should add, disagreed with my assessment. All five justices on that court agreed with the majority opinion, which found that Elaine Photography's refusal to serve Vanessa Willock violated the New Mexico Human Rights Act, which prohibits a public accommodation from refusing to offer its services to a person based on that person's sexual orientation. Now, one of the justices, Justice Richard Bosson, B-O-S-S-O-N, wrote a special concurrence, sort of wringing his hands about the history of the freedom of speech and how it's an important value, how Loving versus Virginia also expresses important values about equality, and how here, even though it's not the Elaine photography, isn't acting with the power of the state and isn't trying to deny anybody's gay marriage, effectively complying with these anti-discrimination laws akin to the anti-Jim Crow laws about desegregating hotels, lunch counters, and all the rest, is the price that one pays for citizenship, for living in our society, effectively, is what it's saying. And I'm going to read this paragraph just because I think it's a fairly strong exposition of that view, that perspective on this clash between individual liberty and equality or principles of equal protection. On a larger scale, this case provokes reflection on what this nation is all about, its promise of fairness, liberty, equality of opportunity, and justice. At its heart, this case teaches that at some point in our lives, all of us must compromise, if only a little, to accommodate the contrasting values of others. A multicultural, pluralistic society, one of our nation's strengths, demands no less. The Huguenins are free to think, to say, to believe as they wish. They may pray to the God of their choice and follow those commandments in their personal lives wherever they lead. The Constitution protects the Huguenins in that respect and much more. But there is a price, one that we all have to pay somewhere in our civic life. In the smaller, more focused world of the marketplace, of commerce, of public accommodation, the Huguenins have to channel their conduct, not their beliefs, so as to leave space for other Americans who believe something different. That compromise is part of the glue that holds us together as a nation, the tolerance that lubricates the varied moving parts of us as a people. That sense of respect we owe others, whether or not we believe as they do, illuminates this country, setting it apart from the discord that afflicts much of the rest of the world. In short, I would say to the Huguenins, with the utmost respect, it is the price of citizenship. I think that's terrible. I like some of the sentiments, obviously, but I think it's a terrible result for the freedom of speech and association and for religious liberty. As I've said before many times and filed briefs to this effect, even supporters of marriage equality and equality generally should not be blind to other violations of fundamental rights. The New Mexico law is one of multiple state and federal public accommodation laws that prohibit private discrimination by companies that offer services to the public. These laws, I think in general, but especially with respect to expressive commercial activities even, activities where there are lots of alternatives that, if you don't like this particular, if you can't get your widgets here, you can get your widgets elsewhere. But even more broadly, I think such laws are antithetical to liberty and forbidden by the Constitution. And that was the law of the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court said in the 1883 civil rights cases, that the 14th Amendment, a provision that, of course, speaks to equal protection, doesn't authorize Congress to legislate against discrimination by private citizens. 100 years later, however, the court held that such power exists under the Commerce Clause, so not under the 14th Amendment, not under the equality protections, but all of those anti-Jim Crow rulings, Heart of Atlanta, Ollie's Barbecue. This is an instance, I think, of Commerce Clause abuse. Even where the business is confined to a single state, the court ruled that it affected or had a substantial impact on interstate commerce. I mean, I think if you're going to take a ruling like that on public accommodations, on true public accommodations, then that has to be justified by Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, that this government law is necessary, government action is necessary to prevent the denial of equal protection of the laws more broadly. And of course, Jim Crow wasn't simply private companies, whether it be hotels or other types of businesses that were denying their services, but it was based in official segregation and official discrimination against racial minorities. The legislation here in Elaine Photography, of course, didn't come from Congress, so it's not an issue of federal power, the Commerce Clause, or anything else. But even if a state legislature has the authority to act in a specific area, that authority can't be exercised, I would argue, in a manner that violates the constitutional rights of those subject to it. Yet the New Mexico Supreme Court disagreed with the position that we took, with the position that Elaine Photography took, and held that compelling someone to engage in artistic photography somehow doesn't violate the freedom of speech if they aren't forced to broadcast a particular government-sponsored message. And even if you agree with the court that New Mexico's law doesn't violate Elaine Photography's speech rights, I think it does violate the company's freedom of association and freedom of contract, two rights that, while not explicitly named in the Constitution, I think are clearly implicit in our understanding of liberty. The right to freely associate and contract with others must include a negative right not to do so, or that right is meaningless. This isn't a defense of bigoted business practices, but a defense of choice, and it applies across the board. I don't like homophobia or racism or any other number of irrational or even deplorable attitudes, but as I said on 2020 last month, a kind of a fun program, being a jerk isn't illegal. And so there you go. The Supreme Court has been hostile to freedom of association and contract since the 1930s, notably in the 1984 case of Roberts versus U.S. JCs, where the court upheld a law that required the JCs, which is a private self-help and leadership training group, to begin admitting women over the membership's objections, and more recently in Christian Legal Society versus Martinez, in which we also filed a brief. The court ruled that a Christian student group couldn't restrict candidacy for leadership and officer positions to students who share the group's faith. So accordingly, Democrats apparently have to admit Republicans, PETA has to admit to leadership positions meat lovers, and so forth. And I think in these cases, the Supreme Court, like the New Mexico Supreme Court, held that the government's interest in equality and non-discrimination allows it to run roughshod over individual liberties. I think I'll stop there, I hope there's lots of questions. There are a lot of different ways that this discussion can be taken.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Ilya. We're going to open the floor in a moment to your questions. You'll hear a prompt that says the floor mode is on. If you have a question, to request the floor, press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and then the pound key. And while we're waiting for the first question, I just want to add a quick programming note that many of our practice group podcasts are available at fedsoc.org on our website to stream or download. So if you miss one of our Teleform conference calls, many times several days after, you can check our website, and then the podcasts are available to stream or download there, and with new calls and new recordings being added daily. Well, we do have several questions on the line, so we'll go ahead and go to our first question.
Hello. Thank you very much, Mr. Shapiro. My name is Ron Colombo. I teach at Hofstra Law School, and I actually have an interest in First Amendment issues and free exercise questions. And what I found particularly interesting about the language of the state Supreme Court, and I love your reaction to this, is that paragraph you read. I'm so happy you read it, the very last paragraph of, I think it was the concurrence. What boggles my mind is why that same language, which you said you detested, I didn't think it was so bad, but why does that only apply one way? Right? When it would seem as though the consumers are entering the marketplace just as much as the photographers have entered the marketplace, and all this respect for diversity and pluralism that we ask of the photographers, why does that not also hold true, it would seem, for the consumers? Why can't that same argument cut both ways?
Yeah, I think so. And, I mean, the court talks about, I think this might have either been a failure of briefing or just that the New Mexico Supreme Court stylized selectively took the examples that it wanted, but there was a discussion of, well, would a black photographer have to photograph a Ku Klux Klan wedding, say? And the court sort of brushed that off by saying, well, political belief isn't one of the protected classes or categories, and so no, they wouldn't. But a Ku Klux Klan photographer would have to photograph a black wedding. Well, what about something like much more closer to this? What about a gay photographer and an ultra-fundamentalist wedding of whatever religion, be it Christian, Muslim, Jewish, whatever, who are clearly opposed not just to gay marriage but to homosexuality. And you know, again, you know, why would someone like that hire a gay photographer, you know, just to prove a point, to make them feel awkward, what have you. But anyhow, apparently under the law, they would have to do that. And I think that is noxious. You're telling people that you have to do things against your that you find very uncomfortable, against your religious beliefs, perhaps you know, provoke some feelings of nausea or what have you. And not just that you have to take that contract, you have to provide that service, but what if, you know, you aren't able to do that very well because as you're cropping and adjusting and taking pictures, you're just not on your game as much as you would be if, you know, this was something that you had no problem with. And then would there be a breach of contract claim there? What kind of a remedy ultimately? What kind of damages? I mean, you couldn't order specific performance, you know, be a better photographer in this case or something like that. So you get into a lot of sort of hairy situations when you're trying to enforce these sorts of provisions. I agree. I think a live and let live pluralistic society, to the extent that those paragraphs, I think you're right, and I may have spoken a little too strongly, is the way to go. But it should go not just both ways, but all ways. I mean, I'm obviously coming from the Cato Institute. I'm reluctant to endorse any government coercion of hardly any kind. So I think that's a point well taken.
Well, it looks like we have currently two questions pending on the line. So if you have a question, remember to press star and then the pound key to get in line, and we will move to our next question.
Hi, thanks for a great discussion. I had two questions that I'd like the speaker to elaborate a little bit on. The whole idea of the development of a special class of protected people in American history, I'm just wondering, how did that gain so much steam when equality before the law was such a foundation of American jurisprudence? It seems like they got their toe in the door and then it just got kicked wide open. And you know, and as a follow-up to that, the whole idea that now we have moved because of this, because of legalism, we've moved away from legislation and voting to let's sue each other to our goal now. So you can imagine evangelical Christians deciding, well, let's go find a gay photographer and ask them to photograph our gay to straight conversion ceremony. And then when they deny it, we can sue them under this law. So those kind of two questions, the special class and then the whole idea of using the legal system in the courts as a shortcut to achieve the social goals you want.
Well, the it's not so much special class or kind of extra class, but over our history, of course, there have been instances of official discrimination by the government, not by private businesses or individuals, but by state and federal governments against racial, sexual, religious, all sorts of minority groups. And so the word race, the word sex, is mentioned in the Constitution in some of its amendments. Now, that we did move from the idea of preventing official discrimination, from saying that the government has to treat everybody equally, to preventing private discrimination, and that happened with the 1964 Civil Rights Act that Congress passed, and that subsequently other states enacted other similar laws, and that dealt not just with official discrimination, but with private discrimination, as I laid out, that had for a long time, the Supreme Court said, went beyond the power of Congress to legislate against, at least under the 14th Amendment. And as I said, the new Civil Rights Act, the new anti-discrimination clauses were actually justified using the Commerce Clause. And it's a very fine line between going from having a shield to protect equal protection and equality to using it as a sword to enforce a sort of equality of thought or political correctness. So yeah, as I said in response to the previous question, I very well could imagine evangelicals wanting to, you know, just to prove a point to hire a gay photographer or any other number of things. In the Christian Legal Society case, that was at Cal Hastings, Cal Berkeley Law School. Was it Berkeley or Hastings? I'm confused now. Anyway, one of the University of California law schools, the court ruled that, yes, indeed, there can be no restrictions, no discrimination, no viewpoint-based restrictions on membership or voting rights or officership possibilities for student groups at public institutions. So, as I said, you know, the Democrats have to admit Republicans, and the environmentalists have to admit that, you know, the Sierra Club has to admit the energy lobby, and any other type of the Jews have to admit the Muslims, and the cats have to admit the dogs, and et cetera, et cetera. And it makes a mockery out of freedom of association laws.
Excellent. Well, we have currently one question pending on the line, and then our lines will be open. So again, if you have a question, enter star and then the pound key. That's star and the pound key.
Great presentation, Ilya. I'd like to challenge you a little bit, though. You had mentioned that Cato is immersed in the argument about expression in First Amendment. And I'm thinking to myself that if you ask any chef whether or not their craft is a form of expression, they're going to say yes. And that leads me back to the Jim Crow laws of the South and people being refused service at restaurants. So isn't the reason they drew the line at public providers kind of to have a clear line so that you could get around any kind of line drawing about whether or not a chef is an artist and, you know, expressing himself and has those rights that need to be protected? The second thing I wanted to mention was you said something about improper motives. And when I'm thinking of these people, I'm thinking of them like housing inspectors that go into racially segregated areas, try to buy a home, and look out for obstacles in their way in the real estate industry. So I don't know why you'd characterize that as impure motives unless you just disagree with the concept of private of government banning private discrimination. And the third part I wanted to ask you about was I think Cato's been around 30 or 40 years. And you keep saying that, you know, discrimination is abominable. But in all those 30 or 40 years, has there never been a case where a black person has been discriminated against on religious grounds? I mean, Bible is used to justify slavery and all sorts of discrimination. In all that time, Cato was never able to identify a case with a black plaintiff. I mean, I think that makes the gay side of this really feel like this is really about discrimination. It's really about picking on them as a class. And that's what they're fighting so hard against.
All right. Well, I appreciate those points. Let's see if I can remember all those questions all the way through. First one is about whether there's really a free speech claim, or at least something distinct between or creative or artistic about photography and creative cake design and, I don't know, a wedding singer, other type of artistic things versus a caterer or a banquet hall owner or other things that, you know, there might be less of the person's artistry involved, but there's some. And, you know, do we want courts judging that line? I think you put the argument against the distinction that I drew better than the New Mexico Supreme Court did. It basically said it accepted that there was such a thing as more creative or expressive professions, but then said that there wasn't a carve-out for them. So it didn't quibble with, you know, a caterer, you know, a caterer or a chef you know, has some artistic quotient to them, and we're not going to, you know, draw that line. It said, okay, we accept your premise that there are artistic or expressive types of businesses, but they're still all public accommodations, and we're not going to make an exception for them. I would argue that renting out a banquet hall or cooking, I mean, you certainly put your efforts and your energy and your thoughts into that, you know, your business acumen about how you structure the pricing scheme for your banquet hall rentals on, you know, on which day. And, you know, there's lots of things, like, let alone a chef, you know, having his flourishes and signature ingredients and et cetera, et cetera. So it's not about whether someone is, using their intellect or their emotion or their feelings or their own personal touch in how they run their business, but more, I don't know, I'm not going to articulate it very well on the fly, perhaps, but whether it's objectively what is presented to the public, whether they see it as some sort of artistic or expressive activity, or whether it's, you know, it could be, there are some cases, sometimes the courts say, you know, what is the predominant characteristic? And for a caterer, that's, you know, feeding people. For a banquet hall, it's renting out the space, and, you know, whatever artistic notions there might be, unless, say, the caterer is cooking their baked mashed potatoes in the initials of the couple or something like that. That's really personalized and akin to the wedding cake. You know, if people are really treating that as an artistic product rather than a consumable or something like that, I think there is a way to articulate that line. But at the end of the day, I mean, as I said, I don't think it really should matter. I think if you're having if you have a private business, I do oppose private discrimination laws generally. You know, unless there's some state underpinning there, and as I said, in the Jim Crow South, which is wasn't just private laws. In fact, a lot of the businesses wanted to have segregation gotten rid of, so that they couldn't act alone, because then they'd be pilloried and the Klan would attack them, and you know, all sorts of that history that thankfully is decades old now. As to, you know, Cato's been in existence for 35, 36 years now, I think. Has a black person ever been, or a woman, or, you know, pick your other protected category, ever been discriminated against for religious grounds? Sure. I mean, for that matter, I don't think it matters whether it's on religious grounds or anything else. And that's, you know, I think someone should be able to run their business, conduct their private affairs for any reason or no reason at all. I just don't, you know, I think we are consistent in protecting the freedom of association, including the freedom not to associate with people. I think that outside of in places where there isn't official discrimination, where the government is actively taking steps to treat people to violate equal protection, I think the marketplace will quickly adjust to take care of, you know, there'll be niche markets for evangelicals, or in some areas they're simply you know, the people that don't want to hire the best person regardless of gender or race or sexual orientation will face a competitive disadvantage, and so my presumption would be that discrimination laws, unless you can show me that that the marketplace will not correct those sorts of deficiencies, and people have no way out, and their rights are being violated, they can't simply move away and, you know, live where they're more welcome, then I think these laws are hard to justify.
Looks like we've got one question on the line before our lines are open again. Again, star and then the pound key.
Yeah. Elliot, are you up to speed on cases involving pharmacy prescription of birth control pills and that sort of stuff as relates to religious liberty? And are there cases in that area coming out the same way as in this area?
I'm aware of the issue generally. I haven't followed, you know, the latest trends. I have been following the Obamacare contraceptive mandate about employers having to include certain things that they find objectionable in their health insurance policies. CADA will probably be filing a brief supporting the employers in those types of cases. In the pharmaceutical cases, again, I think it's a private pharmacy, and if the business has a policy that they are going to sell birth control or other things that some people might have objections to on religious grounds or what have you, you know, if you're being employed as a pharmacist by that business, you have to comply with what your boss tells you. And if you don't like it, then go work at a different pharmacy. So, you know, again, I don't want to say that CADA is always for the quote-unquote religious party. We are for the private individual running his private business in the way that he wants, whether that be pro-gay, pro-religious, pro-religious gay, or anything else.
All right, looks like we've got two more questions on the line. We should have plenty of time to get to both of them.
I have a question, just your opinion on how virile this ruling is from New Mexico. Is there an antithesis to this, perhaps, in other states? Could they rule differently to prevent this kind of decision? And really the question I have leads to religious liberty and expression in general. Is the H word going to become like the N word? You know, when do Christians begin to have to be concerned about, you know, I think we always are concerned, but in our public discourse about issues that we don't want to train our children a certain way. We talk about this issue with homosexuality as being an issue. And yet in some venues, it's not even acceptable to even say those kinds of words. So just how virile is this issue in New Mexico to other states?
Well, not all states have human rights commissions. And thankfully, the First Amendment with respect to freedom of speech is still strong enough in this country that we haven't had instances with, like other countries have had with human rights commissions and other courts that have punished people for their speech, including religious ministers, on topics relating to whether it be homosexuality or other topics, immigration, lots of other things that have happened in Canada, in Holland, in England. And those are issues that have become real topics of public debate. In fact, Canada just last year passed a law repealing the particular section that had the Federal Human Rights Commission going after hate speech, in effect. You know, we have hate crime laws, which I find objectionable, that you get a harsher penalty if you commit murder for one reason versus another, say. But we do not, and the Supreme Court would not uphold a hate speech law, you know, unless, again, the typical thing where you're inciting violence or something like that. This case, I know there will be a cert petition out of this New Mexico case, out of Elaine Photography. It'll be obviously closely watched whether the Supreme Court even takes it. I mean, it's the first case of its kind that's run its course that I'm aware of. There are other cases that are making their way through the various state court systems elsewhere, and particularly this is the first such ruling anywhere after that I'm aware of after the Windsor decision on striking down Section 3 of DOMA. We'll have to see. It could be a trend. It might not. It depends. These sorts of cases will start making it into the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, whether state anti-discrimination laws, when they conflict with all sorts of claims, whether it be First Amendment or other types of things. So I don't think that anytime soon churches will have to perform marriages or other types of ceremonies that they're against. I don't think anytime soon you're going to be arrested for writing an article that someone finds objectionable. But in terms of these sorts of businesses, And in terms of public education, I should add, that's one thing that you raised, how you teach your children. Anytime the government is involved, these sorts of clashes over values are inevitable, and that's another reason why Cato advocates for limited government, because in a pluralistic society, people are going to disagree, and each one of us might have different views on different things, and that's okay as long as the government isn't coercing me to adopt your views or you to adopt my views.
Well, it looks like we've got about 10 minutes left on the call and two questions left, and we should be able to get to both. So please, when on your question, please try to keep your question as brief as possible so we have time to get as much in on the call as possible.
Hi again. This is Ron. I got back in line. I wanted to ask you, when you went over the litany of cases in which associational rights have not fared well, you did leave out the Dale versus Boy Scouts case, which was the one that bucked the trend. And I was curious how you'd fit that in with the rest. And do you think that's just now bad law, or do you think that actually shows there is a minimum? And I'll get off the phone as per the instructions.
Well, Boy Scouts versus Dale has to do with expressive association, and when you get together to promote a particular message, that association is protected, and you can curtail your membership or discriminate in terms of how you run your meetings or what have you, even if you're a quasi-public organization. I'm not sure if that distinction, that articulation, I mean, I think the case turned out the right way. I'm not sure if the way that the court decided it will stand or will be pressured in these ways that you've mentioned. Here, of course, Oil Lane Photography, it's not so much the association, the two photographers amongst themselves, and they're being forced to hire a gay photographer, say, or hire a photographer specifically for gay marriage. That could be the next case. But here it's the association between client and or business and customer, which runs under the rubric of public accommodations law more than expressive association. But yes, I mean, Boy Scouts versus Dale was a pro freedom of association when that association has an expressive element, which is part of the reason why we, in our brief, tried to accentuate the expressive aspect of this business activity.
Well, our last question that was on the line had dropped off, so we do have time for one more. So if you would like to request the floor, please press star and then the pound key. And it looks like our caller is back.
Yes, hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, you are on the line.
Oh, great, great. Sorry, I got cut off before. Sorry about that. I just wanted to make three points. One, we probably shouldn't refer to same-sex marriage as gay marriage, since gays have not been excluded from what we call traditional marriage, and presumably straight people wouldn't be excluded from marriage. But and it also just invites people to view same-sex civil rights. Secondly, I would say that the civil rights issue, the revolution and the post-Civil War period has been hijacked. The 14th Amendment was adopted for a very specific purpose. It was dealing with the issue of slavery and blacks being really badly, badly mistreated in the South because of, again, the badges and incidents of slavery. Had we not had a 14th Amendment, we probably wouldn't. If there was no slavery issue, and there was no 13th and 14th and 15th Amendment, I don't think there'd be an expectation that we would need to treat other classifications equally, would have a demand for equality for the classifications. Third, the question I have is, and you may have addressed this, but I might have missed it, is there a principal line that we could draw between, the standard notion of a public accommodation, amusement parks, hotels, things like that, and things like catering and photography, where someone is being asked to travel and perform a particular task that sort of thing. So that's all I had to say. Thank you very much.
Sure. Well, I appreciate the first two points. I sort of use gay marriage and same-sex marriage interchangeably, and people correct me from time to time, whatever I use. I just mean, you know, a marriage between people of the same sex. But no offense to lesbians or anybody else who isn't included in the term gay marriage or the idea of a union officially recognized of same-sex couples. Anyhow, I think there could be a line drawn. It's hard to articulate because you could say that between amusement parks, places that throw open their doors, restaurants, you know, and people that provide services, say. But even then, it gets murky because how do you treat food trucks, you know, which are moving restaurants that do provide the service of, you know, feeding you as well. I don't know if, you know, the idea that just because it's hard to draw a line, you know, you can see that some things are clearly on one side or another. If a train, say, or a bus line, probably more a train because you don't have competing train services, is the prototypical public accommodation, and I don't know, a specially commissioned painting is the prototypical artistic service, and you can have things kind of on a spectrum in between. But that one caller of earlier was right. Chefs, cooks put a lot of their own efforts and flourishes into what they prepare. But are we going to be drawing the line either legislatively or judicially, legally, between a short order cook at a diner versus some gourmet chef that, you know, uses secret ingredients and, you know, has a thing that's not replicated anywhere? Is that the test, that this is unique, that, you know, you cannot quite get the same service anywhere? Well, then you can argue that, well, even though there's hundreds of photographers, you can only get this particular style, you know, unique expressive ability from this particular photographer. So I think it's a tricky question. I mean, if it's easier kind of politically or legally more palatable to draw some sort of line between traditional public accommodations, such as hotels and restaurants, versus other types of business services, I'm not sure how satisfying that is from a rigorous logic perspective, but it certainly would be less controversial politically and in terms of courts jurisprudentially having to make these tough calls. So I welcome more freedom of association and contract and expression. I personally would go the whole hog, the fuller, you know, even allow hotels and restaurants. I don't think they would long survive in today's environment, but I would let them try. But if there is a way to draw that line, and I'm punting a little bit, and I've kind of offered some speculative ways that a line could be drawn, or at least a standard could be drawn, and then you have some hard cases, then I think that would advance the ball from something like this New Mexico decision.
This is Christian Corrigan. And with that, we are actually just about out of time. So on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert, Ilya Shapiro, today from the Cato Institute. Thank you to our audience for tuning in. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Remember, on our website, you can catch this podcast as well as many others from Teleform conference calls instantly streaming or downloaded anytime at fedsoc.org. And also remember to check out our new blog for the Executive Branch Review Project, executivebranchproject.com, all one word. So again, thank you to our audience and Ilya Shapiro. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.